Welcome to A Fragment of Time. My name is Andy Mamady, and you are listening to CoRadio.org.
It seemed clear by now that the nonviolence of the Southern movement, perhaps tactically necessary in the Southern atmosphere, and effective because it could be used to appeal to national opinion against the segregationist South, was not enough to deal with the entrenched problems of poverty in the black ghetto. In 1910, 90% of Negroes lived in the South. But by 1965, mechanical cotton pickers harvested 81% of Mississippi Delta cotton. Between 1940 and 1970, 4 million blacks left the country for the city. By 1965, 80% of blacks lived in cities, and 50% of the black people lived in the North. There was a new mood in SNCC and among many militant blacks. Their disillusionment was expressed by a young black writer, Julius Lester. "Now it is over. America has had chance after chance to show that it really meant that all men are endowed with certain inalienable rights. Now it is over. The days of singing freedom songs and the days of combating bullets and billy clubs with love. Love is fragile and gentle and seeks a like response. They used to sing, 'I love everybody,' as they ducked bricks and bottles. Now they sing, 'Too much love, too much love. Nothing kills a nigger like too much love.'"
You are listening to A Fragment of Time. My name is Andy Mamady. My apartment is infested with koala bears. It is the cutest infestation ever. Way better than cockroaches. When I turn on the lights, a bunch of koala bears scatter. But I do not want them to.
I had always believed that it is better to know the truth than to live in ignorance. Now I shall find out if I was right. I can no longer deny that I am part of the world around me.
Nothing makes sense.
We went right on to work in our factories and offices and laundromats and record shops.
The way our system works, you pay for the privilege of being propaganda.
Working conditions that are worse in many respects than slavery.
That's what's being driven out of people's heads. You're only supposed to care about yourself.
Thank you.
work on command, you're some kind of slave. You know? Why not work because it's coming out of your needs and interests?
Finding ways to challenge a capitalist system. We're talking about capitalism in the age of globalization, right? We're talking about global capitalism.
These things don't even occur to people.
So I guess what I want to suggest that we all do is figure out ways of making these issues visible.
Snippets of conversations are like raindrops. They make me wet.
Mark Twain said about patriotism and about loyalty, because people ask him, why aren't you loyal? He said, my kind of loyalty was loyalty to one's country, not to its institutions or its office holders. The country is the real thing, the substantial thing, the eternal thing. It is the thing to watch over and care for and be loyal to. Its institutions are extraneous. They're its mere clothing, and clothing can wear out, become ragged, cease to be comfortable, cease to protect the body from winter, disease, and death. To be loyal to rags, to shout for rags, to worship rags, to die for rags, that is a loyalty of unreason.
And now with the rags' liberation.
Stephen Colbert, and tonight it is my privilege to celebrate this president, because we're not so different, he and I. We both get it. Guys like us, we're not some brainiacs on the nerd patrol. We're not members of the Factinista. We go straight from the gut, right, sir? That's where the truth lies, right down here in the gut. Do you know you have more nerve endings in your gut than you have in your head? You can look it up. Now I know some of you are going to say I did look it up, and that's not true. That's because you looked it up in a book. Next time, look it up in your gut. I did. My gut tells me that's how our nervous system works. I give people the truth unfiltered by rational argument. I'm a simple man with a simple mind. I hold a simple set of beliefs that I live by. Number one, I believe in America. I believe it exists. My gut tells me I live there. I feel that it extends from the Atlantic to the Pacific. And I strongly believe it has 50 states. I believe in democracy. I believe democracy is our greatest export. At least until China figures out a way to stamp it out of plastic for 3 cents a unit. I believe the government that governs best is the government that governs least. And by these standards, we have set up a fabulous government in Iraq. And though I am a committed Christian, I believe that everyone has the right to their own religion, be you Hindu, Jewish, or Muslim. I believe there are infinite paths to accepting Jesus Christ as your personal savior. Ladies and gentlemen, I believe it's yogurt, but I refuse to believe it's not butter. Most of all, I believe in this president. Now, I know there's some polls out there saying that, this man has a 32% approval rating. But guys like us, we don't pay attention to the polls. We know that, polls are just a collection of statistics that reflect what people are thinking in reality. And reality has a well-known liberal bias. Sir, pay no attention to the people who say the glass is half empty. Because 32% means it's two-thirds empty. There's still some liquid in that glass, is my point.
There is a sweet cookhouse not far away, where we get sweet jam all three times a day. Ham and eggs we never see, damn old sugar in our tea, and we are gradually fading away. Old soldiers never die, never die, never die. Old soldiers never die, they just fade away.
War needs to be presented on film in such a way as to create a new population of people who will simply say no to war. We need to see that more and more. We need a film about the those heroic Americans who protested against World War I. They were socialists, they were pacifists, they were just people who saw the stupidity of the war that was taking the lives of 10 million people in Europe and which now the United States was entering. Now we look for people who can be really interesting characters in films. And you look at some of the people who at that important point during World War I opposed the war. You see Emma Goldman, the feminist, anarchist, who goes to prison for opposing the draft and the war. You see Helen Keller. I haven't seen Helen Keller in any film other than the kind of film that extols the fact that she was a disabled person and she became an important person. But I've never seen a film in which Helen Keller is presented as what she was, a radical, a socialist, an anti-war agitator, somebody who would refuse to cross a picket line which was set up against a play which was about her. A remarkable subject for a film. Or I think of Kate Richards O'Hare, the socialist who was put in jail for opposing World War I, and that great scene in the prison where they're stifling for lack of air, and she takes a book that she's been reading and reaches through the bars and hurls the book through the skylight above the prison corridor and lets the air in. And all the prisoners applaud and cheer because finally they're getting some fresh air. Well, I could say a lot more about possible stories and scenarios about war, about World War II. Again, a good war, right? The best of wars, but not that simple. And that's why Studs Terkel, when he did his oral history called The Good War, he put quotation marks around good war, if you notice. Because of the war, yes, humanitarian sympathies and fighting against a terrible evil, fascism, and on the other hand, a war marked by our own atrocities that multiplied as the war went on, culminating in Hiroshima and Nagasaki. And I have not seen a film that dealt with our bombing of Hiroshima. I mean, the closest that we come to a film which deals with our bombing of civilian population is Kurt Vonnegut's book, the film that was made about Slaughterhouse-5. But that was an oddity, a rarity.
There is cheese that brings you to your knees.
In the store, there is cheese that brings you to your knees. In the quartermaster store,
there is tea, but not for you and me.
In the store, there is tea, but not for you and me. In the quartermaster store.
There are rats in bowler hats and spats.
In the store, there are rats in bowler hats and spats. In the quartermaster store,
there are beans that make you fill your jeans.
In the store, there are beans that make you fill your jeans. In the quartermaster store.
There's a chief who never brings us beef.
In the store,
there's a chief who never brings us beef. In the quartermaster store.
Conclusion?
There is a certain social process which is known and very visible, but perhaps not acknowledged as much as it should be. It is that one where a new idea, or an old one in new form, is accepted by a minority, while the majority are shouting treason, rubbish, kook, communist,
anarchist,
capitalist, or whatever is the term of abuse valued in that society.
Infringer.
And they develop this idea, at first probably in secrecy or in semi-secrecy, and then more and more visibly, with more and more support, until, guess what? This seditious, impossible, wrong-headed idea becomes what is known as received opinion, and is loved and valued by the majority.
Conclusion?
Look, people, you heard it on the radio.
I get one.
You seen it on a TV show.
Okay, you better listen to me good, because this is the ABCs of anarchism.
Okay.
If ever the free institutions of America are destroyed, that event may be attributed to the unlimited authority of the majority and oblige them to have recourse to physical force. Anarchy will then be the result.
Being involved in something like this, I tell you, it can strip the hope right out of you. You start really looking the beast in the face day after day, and you see what the problems are. And you do all those kinds of good things you're taught to do. You write and you call your member of Congress. You write letters to the editor. You go out and vote. It makes no difference.
Anarchism actually is the opposite of all of that.
Early morning fog I see visions of the things to be.
Tinky Winky.
Sing songs that remind him of the good times.
All the Teletubbies were feeling very, very happy.
He sings the songs that remind him of the best times.
Where's my head? Let me think. No, I don't keep it under the sink.
I know no country in which there is so little true independence of mind and freedom of discussion as in America.
Well, what I think we ought to do is get rid of everyone we got in there and straight out. Even Republican or Democrat,
clean house.
We got to get something to change the system somehow. I don't know how. I don't know how. I don't know how. I don't know how. I don't know how.
You must avoid the government of democracy.
Would they prefer anarchy?
The founding fathers hated two things. They hated democracy and they hated monarchy. And they saw to it that we would have neither.
Conclusion?
This is your friendly, stupid weatherman reminding you that when they can't have their anarchism, I have to make it right for them. Every time. How about that?
Would they prefer anarchy?
I don't know.
It seemed that life was so
think I'm crazy? I'm not. I'm an anemone, and you are listening to A Fragment of Time.
I am the stone that the builder refused. I am the visual, the inspiration that made ladies sing the blues. I'm the spark that makes your idea bright. The same spark that lights the dark so that you can know your left from your right. I am the ballad in your box, the bullet in the gun, the inner glow that let you know to call your brother son. The story that just begun, the promise of what's to come. And I'ma remain a soldier till the war is won. One, chop, 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 flip, chop, 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 flip, chop, chop, chop.
Has that flag-waving, cheerleading, rah-rah bullshit stopped or died down at all? Really? It's still going? It's fucking, oh, what a bummer that shit is. Oh, I get it. The first, like, week, I get it. I get it, especially when it's, like, you know, firemen around. You wave it at the firemen, you go, yeah. But, I mean, after, like, 4 months, you know, and you see these fucking, you know, trophy wives with their fucking $80,000 Lexus SUVs driving around with flags. You're like, shut the fuck up. Stop it. You're just encouraging more bomb. Stop it. It doesn't mean anything to you. It's just a completely empty gesture. It's like, what does that mean to you? It means united we stand. No, I read the bumper sticker. I mean, tell me in your words what it means. It means these colors do not run. No. Okay. Yeah, I get it. I get it. I get it. So it's just, what, you know, they're just part of a club. They're just excited to be part of the flag waving club on their street. Look, we're all waving flags. Ha 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 ha. Flags, hooray. And it's so fucking such an empty gesture and so full of like this crass commercialization. Like, you know, fucking 24 hours after those fucking buildings went down, people all over the country are going, I own a flag distribution thing. Hello. Hello, ribbon money. Hello, flag money. You know, and it was like 3 days later when you couldn't turn on the TV without seeing those fucking infomercials for, like, you know, the Freedom Kit. You know? 12 different size flags you can stick everywhere. The Freedom Kit for $14.99. And then upgrade for $10. Get the Patriot Pack. 10 different flags. 10 more flags. 10 bigger size flags. Be a better patriot than the people who get the Freedom Kit. Outdo your neighbors in patriotism. Let them know you're better than the Freedom Kit people. 27 different flags. Stick them on your car. Stick them in your window. Stick them in your office. Stick them on your cubicle. Fucking shove them up your ass. We got special flags to shove up your ass when you're sleeping. No reason not to be a patriot when you're asleep. Come on, don't let those terrorists win. If you don't have a flag sticking out of your ass, the terrorists win. Always have flags. Give your children flags. Everyone should have a flag. All the time, at all times, flags. Eat the flag. Eat it. Special edible flags. Have flags grafted on the inside of your eyelids so all times you have flags. Have flag pills to eat, and then you shit out a flag. That's true patriotism. Don't be asleep on the job here, America. So order today. All flags made by Chinese prison labor. Guaranteed. Guaranteed. How's that for a kind of weird global karmic irony? There are guys, there are dissidents in China making our flags so that people who remain willfully ignorant in this country... These guys, people are in jail for, like, expressing the opinion, like, I'd like to have more papers to read, you know. Yet we live in a country where you actually have access to the news, and nobody wants it. They don't want to get the real news. I'm too busy to get on the Guardian UK website. That's the fucked up thing. I got to read other countries' papers to find out what's going on in my country. That's fucked up. That ain't right. Mm-mm. That shit ain't right. And I don't know for sure. I need my beer for this. I don't know for sure. And I won't know for many years. It's going to be quite a while. But.
Black and red, red and black, black and red, red and black, anarchism. Being a human being that stems from your inner impulses and not from the social pressure of anyone else. Determining if authority is justified. And if it isn't, dissolving it. Living in a world where all human beings are equal, and work to help each other and ourselves out. It's about being more than just a slave to someone else. We will work together and save money by removing the overhead that corporations take as profit to pay those CEOs who act in a way that is disgusting in its depravity. This is anarchism.
I like to party fucking hard! I like my rock and roll the same! Don't give a fuck if I burn out! Don't give a fuck if I fade away! Back to the Motor League with me! Before I fall to face the wrath of a well-refined public who lived by cheering on the bleed through! Tortured out his car and drugs for punching Macho Pablo! Back to the Motor League I go! Once thought I drew a lucky hand, turned out to be a live grenade! Oh my god! Oh shit! Single fender winners struck a straight edge. Fuck off, who cares? I'd rather have my triptychs than listen to your bullshit. Fuck off, who cares? A bunch of stupid scenes, your shitty scenes, your straw men you build up to burn never ceases to amaze. And as I'm suffering a perfection, reminds me of my own race. Redress my own debt is the real mouth feet, eating hats, teeny balls. Small books, drunken brawls. What hell? We're here. 15 years later, it still reeks of swill and chicken conformists. Fist in the air. Like father, like some rebels, blood on corn, M&M's and biscuits. Right here, a prayer. Take back your Andy Grandma's screws and fair weather politics. Blow dry
my hair
and stick me on a 10-speed. Back to the Motor League. Back to the Motor League. Back to the Motor League. Yes, life is just a popularity contest. This is just a feeling to perform within a framework of obedience.
Stock personnel, front checkouts, front checkouts, stock personnel.
Fuck!
And that's another thing I love is when anybody, like, gears their advertising to, like, a younger demographic and they try to skew stuff, you know, and hip it up, and, you know, sell it to the younger folks, you know, because they always fuck up, you know? And then they attribute these qualities that don't, you know, to products that don't merit them, you know, like eggs or something. And they have this new campaign, you know, Henderson Valley eggs! You're gonna love our eggs! Yeah. This ain't your daddy's egg. Can't skateboard. Finally, an egg for my generation. You know, and they have these bending guitar notes, and then they intercut it with, like, a quiet, like, granny in a rocking chair, you know, sitting there, go, I like eggs the old-fashioned way. Fuck you, granny! Henderson Valley egg! You're gonna love our eggs!
You are listening to A Fragment of Time on CoRadio.org.
And this song is a love song to cigarettes. All right. All those times I tried so hard to put you out, lose their meaning. Every time I think about the cruel and overwhelming. When we kiss, I realize you're killing me. Though I feel it deep inside, I don't believe it when my hands are trembling. It's always just some trick you're playing on me. Flow softly through me and swirl out above me. Make believe you love me and I'll do the same. But are you thinking of me when I'm away? Will it really ever be the same again? When my mind is free from your sweet influence and in no way sedated, I'm going to be right.
expressions on my face, and I'm delighted to take it. Well, I know it's always just some trick you're playing on me. Flow softly through me and swirl around above me. Make believe you love me, and I'll do the same. But are you thinking of me when I'm away?
Within a few weeks, Snowball's plans for the windmill were fully worked out. The mechanical details came mostly from three books which had belonged to Mr. Jones: 1,000 Useful Things to Do About the House, Every Man His Own Bricklayer, and Electricity for Beginners. Snowball used as his study a shed which had once been used for incubators and had a smooth wooden floor suitable for drawing on. He was closeted there for hours at a time. With his books held open by a stone, and with a piece of chalk gripped between the knuckles of his trotter, he would move rapidly to and fro, drawing in line after line, and uttering little whimpers of excitement. Gradually the plans grew into a complicated mass of cranks and cogwheels, covering more than half the floor, which the other animals found completely unintelligible, but very impressive. All of them came to look at Snowball's drawings at least once a day. Even the hens and ducks came, and were at pains not to tread on the chalk marks. Only Napoleon held aloof. He had declared himself against the windmill from the start. One day, however, he arrived unexpectedly to examine the plans. He walked heavily round the shed, looked closely at every detail of the plans, and snuffed at them once or twice, then stood for a little while contemplating them out of the corner of his eye. Then suddenly he lifted his leg, urinated over the plans, and walked out without uttering a word. The whole farm was deeply divided on the subject of the windmill. Snowball did not deny that to build it would be a difficult business. Stone would have to be quarried and built up into walls, then the sails would have to be made, and after that there would be need for dynamos and cables. How these were to be procured, Snowball did not say. But he maintained that it could all be done in a year. And thereafter, he declared, so much labour would be saved that the animals would only need to work 3 days a week. Napoleon, on the other hand, argued that the great need of the moment was to increase food production, and that if they wasted time on the windmill, they would all starve to death. The animals formed themselves into two factions, under the slogans, "Vote for Snowball and the 3 day week," and "Vote for Napoleon and the full manger." Benjamin was the only animal who did not side with either faction. He refused to believe either that food would become more plentiful or that the windmill would save work. "Windmill or no windmill," he said, "life would go on as it had always gone on. That is, badly." Apart from the disputes over the windmill, there was the question of the defence of the farm. It was fully realized that though the human beings had been defeated in the Battle of the Cowshed, they might make another and more determined attempt to recapture the farm and reinstate Mr. Jones. They had all the more reason for doing so, because the news of their defeat had spread across the countryside and made the animals on the neighboring farms more restive than ever. As usual, Snowball and Napoleon were in disagreement. According to Napoleon, what the animals must do was to procure firearms and train themselves in the use of them. According to Snowball, they must send out more and more pigeons and stir up rebellion among the animals on the other farms. The one argued that if they could not defend themselves, they were bound to be conquered. The other argued that if rebellions happened everywhere, they would have no need to defend themselves. The animals listened first to Napoleon, then to Snowball, and could not make up their minds which was right. Indeed, they always found themselves in agreement with the one who was speaking at the moment. At last the day came when Snowball's plans were completed. At the meeting on the following Sunday, the question of whether or not to begin work on the windmill was to be put to the vote. When the animals had assembled in the big barn, Snowball stood up and, though occasionally interrupted by bleating from the sheep, set forth his reasons for advocating the building of the windmill. Then Napoleon stood up to reply. He said very quietly that the windmill was nonsense and that he advised nobody to vote for it, and promptly sat down again. He had spoken for barely 30 seconds, and seemed almost indifferent as to the effect he produced. At this, Snowball sprang to his feet, and shouting down the sheep, who had begun bleating again, broke into a passionate appeal in favour of the windmill. Until now, the animals had been about equally divided in their sympathies, but in a moment Snowball's eloquence had carried them away. In glowing sentences, he painted a picture of Animal Farm as it might be when sordid labour was lifted from the animals' backs. His imagination had now run far beyond chaff cutters and turnip slicers. Electricity, he said, could operate threshing machines, ploughs, harrows, rollers and reapers and binders, besides supplying every stall with its own electric light, hot and cold water, and an electric heater. By the time he'd finished speaking, there was no doubt as to which way the vote would go. But just at this moment, Napoleon stood up and, casting a peculiar sidelong look at Snowball, uttered a high-pitched whimper of a kind no one had ever heard him utter before. At this, there was a terrible baying sound outside, and 9 enormous dogs wearing brass-studded collars came bounding into the barn. They dashed straight for Snowball, who only sprang from his place just in time to escape their snapping jaws. In a moment he was out of the door, and they were after him. Too amazed and frightened to speak, all the animals crowded through the door to watch the chase. Snowball was racing across the long pasture that led to the road. He was running as only a pig can run, but the dogs were close on his heels. Suddenly he slipped, and it seemed certain that they had him. Then he was up again, running faster than ever, then the dogs were gaining on him again. One of them all but closed his jaws on Snowball's tail, but Snowball whisked it free just in time. Then he put on an extra spurt, and with a few inches to spare, slipped through a hole in the hedge and was seen no more. Silent and terrified, the animals crept back into the barn. In a moment, the dogs came bounding back. At first, no one had been able to imagine where these creatures came from. But the problem was soon solved. They were the puppies whom Napoleon had taken away from their mothers and reared privately. Though not yet full grown, they were huge dogs, and as fierce-looking as wolves. They kept close to Napoleon. It was noticed that they wagged their tails to him in the same way as the other dogs had been used to do to Mr. Jones. Napoleon, with the dogs following him, now mounted onto the raised portion of the floor where Major had previously stood to deliver his speech. He announced that from now on the Sunday morning meetings would come to an end. They were unnecessary, he said, and wasted time. In future, all questions relating to the working of the farm would be settled by a special committee of pigs, presided over by himself. These would meet in private and afterwards communicate their decisions to the others. The animals would still assemble on Sunday mornings to salute the flag, sing Beasts of England, and receive their orders for the week, but there would be no more debates. In spite of the shock that Snowball's expulsion had given them, the animals were dismayed by this announcement. Several of them would have protested if they could have found the right arguments. Even Boxer was vaguely troubled. He set his ears back, shook his forelock several times, and tried hard to marshal his thoughts, but in the end he could not think of anything to say. Some of the pigs themselves, however, were more articulate. 4 young porkers in the front row uttered shrill squeals of disapproval, and all 4 of them sprang to their feet and began speaking at once. But suddenly the dogs sitting round Napoleon let out deep, menacing growls, and the pigs fell silent and sat down again. Then the sheep broke out into a tremendous bleating of 4 legs good, 2 legs bad, which went on for nearly a quarter of an hour and put an end to any chance of discussion.
Well, at the outset, I mentioned very briefly the very notable successes of popular struggles in the past decades. It's pretty clear if you think about it a little, very rarely discussed for reasons that aren't hard to discern. Both recent history and public attitudes suggest some pretty straightforward and quite conservative strategies for short-term activism on the part of those who don't want to wait for China to save us from ultimate doom. We do enjoy great privilege and freedom, in fact, uniquely so by comparative and historical standards. That legacy was not granted as a gift from above. It was won. It was won by hard and dedicated struggle, which doesn't reduce to pushing a lever every few years. We can, of course, decide to abandon the legacy. You can take the easy way of pessimism. You know, everything's hopeless, so I quit. Or we can make use of that legacy and work to create, in part to recreate, the basis for a functioning democratic culture in which the public plays some role in determining policies, and not only in the political arena, from which it's largely excluded, but in the crucial economic arena, from which it is excluded in principle. Now, those are not particularly radical ideas. So, for example, they were articulated very clearly by the leading 20th century social philosopher in the United States, John Dewey, who's American as apple pie in the familiar phrase. And he pointed out that until what he called industrial feudalism is replaced by industrial democracy, politics will remain the shadow cast by business over society. Now, Dewey wasn't being particularly original in that. In fact, he was drawing from a long tradition of thought and action that had developed independently in working class culture from the very origins of the Industrial Revolution, actually, right where I live, an area near Boston in the mid-19th century. Those ideas were remain just below the surface, and they can become a living part of our societies and our cultures and our institutions. But like other victories for justice and freedom over the centuries, that's not going to happen by itself. One of the clearest lessons of history, including very recent history, is that rights are not granted. Now, they are won, and the rest of it's up to us.
I don't want love, it's a waste of time. But don't forget, you are mine. I'm a fancy. say these hits are very well. Attitude is no substitute for discipline, rebellion. No hatred is no substitute for discipline, rebellion. To unionize is to agonize. Ha! Ha! Unionize. Fight, fight. Stop, strike. Well, all this talk of fighting back is time to be ignored. We don't know where our power lies, so utilize the tools we've got. The bosses have the money and the workers have no rights. No rights. But our muscle is our labor and we flex it when we go on strike. Strike! Ha! Unionize. Fight, fight, unionize. Stop, fight, unionize. Unionize, yeah. No, no, no. Unionize, yeah. We can tackle rats and pedal bombs and revolutions all day long. We come to organize, we'll waste our lives and put a song. And life within it is waiting to be won. The day the buzz is gone, the day the dream is gone. But now for man's eyes and hollow time is just cursed. We all have to build our rhythm. Fight back!
Dilemma.
I don't know.
Free ham. Hey, Jefe, what do you call four Mexicans in quicksand?
What?
Cuatro cinco.
Hey, Melvin, you know why Hitler committed suicide?
Why?
Because he got the gas bill.
Whoa, guys. Well, that's not funny, man. You crossed the line with that one. I don't know if I ever told you this, but my grandfather, he died in a concentration camp.
Oh, Smelly, that's terrible. I didn't know that.
How did he die?
He fell off a watchtower.
Oh, I can't believe it.